This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and I am really, really pleased, privileged, honored, excited to have as a guest again, I think we did this a couple of years ago, with someone whose name will be instantly familiar to most of our audience, I suspect. If I say to you, Red Feldschoon, bicycle, VW Combi, guitar across the back, that should, and a pork pie hat, that should conjure up all kinds of images for people. And of course, we're talking about the writer, composer, David Kremer. And it is a real pleasure, and as I say, an honor to have you on this program. I've seen most of your shows over the year. My wife and I were talking about this just this morning, and we ran through the litany of things from District 6 to Guma to Cat and the Kings, Fairyland to so many others.
Yeah. There are quite a few.
Either solo or with your late partner, Talib Peterson. You did something which actually is extraordinary. You brought a whole musical tradition out from a more shadowy place in the landscape to make it right smack in the mainstream, let people know it was there, it was alive, it was vibrant, and we should pay real attention to it. What fascinates me is that you came to the, I don't know how you came to this idea of musical theater. You studied textiles at Leeds University in Britain, which is not usually seen as the birthplace for musical theater.
No, I didn't study musical theater at all. You're quite correct. I was a student at Leeds University. I graduated with a BA honors in textile design from that university. But you know, it was a different time. There was no thought of going into the entertainment industry as a profession. You know, one just assumed you had to find some kind of career that might support you. And I had this wonderful opportunity, got a scholarship to study overseas, and it happened to be textile designing. Wasn't exactly my first interest. But what it did for me was that I was there and in the 70s, and I was able to see all the wonderful singer-songwriters coming through the university, performing, you know, starting careers, people like Cat Stevens and Elton John and Rod Stewart and many. We had a university that was very strong in terms of their, what they call their entertainment committee, and they would invite these new artists to come and perform to the students. So it was a wonderful time for me musically, and also gave me an opportunity to perform at the folk clubs in Leeds, where I cut my teeth. This was the beginning of me becoming a singer, songwriter, performer. That was in the early 70s.
You saw all these people who have become, we'll overuse the word, icons in the music and entertainment industry. And you said to yourself one evening over your second beer, if they can do it, I can do it.
I wasn't thinking that at all. I had no sense of myself going into the direction of becoming anything other than a hobby. Let me say, I thought of it as a hobby. I liked performing, and I was starting to write my first songs. I had no idea where this was going to take me. When I came home to South Africa, of course, I went into the textile industry and was working there. And my hobby in the background was, you know, performing here and there on university campuses and the Barleycorn Folk Club in Cape Town and so on. And quickly I developed a name. People took notice of me because I was so different. You know, I really just wasn't doing anything like any of the others were doing, who were all trying to imitate the American and British artists. I think, of course, what made me stand out was I had no interest in becoming a British or American imitation. Mm. I wanted to explore my own identity and to write satirical songs about the ridiculous situation we found ourselves in South Africa. And that's when I discovered that I was able to put humor into my songs, and I could make people laugh. That was a discovery in itself.
When you say you wanted to explore your own musical ideas, had you already thought of the idea of reaching deep into local music traditions and art forms, or did that come a little later?
That came later, Brooks. That came later. Initially, it was just trying to find my feet. I mean, I had no idea what I should do or how I should do it. I just, you know, luckily I had a brother. Oh, I have a brother who's 5 years older than me, and he was at Michaelis Art School when I was, you know, still a teenager. And he came back with some radical ideas at that time, saying, you know, that his professor, Professor Dubow, Neville Dubow, was saying, you know, stop looking overseas. There's very interesting things right here in your backyard. So you can find inspiration in the places that you actually live and come from. And I thought that was quite a ridiculous idea, because I grew up in this town of Worcester, conservative small town, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. I wanted to really get out and escape. I didn't want to start thinking about it or writing about it. I was still hoping to become some kind of, cool singer on the stage. At that point, this is when I'm about 18, 19 years old.
The shift into digging up those roots and following where they would go, in my mind at least, the ultimate version of that was your show Guma, which didn't stop at South African roots, but traced them back to East Asia and Southeast Asia and Portuguese influences. So you were talking about 500-600 years worth of mining of the roots.
Yes, yes. So let me firstly say that my interest in Creole culture, Cape Creole or syncretic culture, started to develop when I came home. I had read a biography of Bob Dylan, and, you know, I found out about how he had been influenced by Woody Guthrie and the roots of American music, and, you know, one thing leads to another. And that started me thinking about, where do I fit into the picture in terms of South Africa, and what are the roots of South African music? This is where it begins. Around about 1974, I come home, I start thinking about music, roots music, and for me, yeah, in the Cape, that's Afrikaans. Afrikaans roots music, and the discovery I make is that the history I was taught is nothing like the history of the country or this place. And that Afrikaans is not the white man's language that they kept telling me it was. 1976, the Soweto uprisings, students are saying, you know, we're not going to be taught in the oppressor's language. And I completely understood that. But what wasn't known then was that the real roots of Afrikaans come from slavery and Dutch, and these various influences are rolled around like sharp stones in the mouths of slaves and become Afrikaans. So yes, there's a contribution from white people. They had no incentive. Let's say this. The people who owned slaves and their descendants in the Cape spoke Dutch, and they obviously there was no reason for them to invent a new language for themselves. The only thing was the people who were working for them had to find a way to communicate. I mean, these are people who came, as you say, from the Indian Ocean Basin with nothing but themselves and their original stories, and had to find a new way to survive culturally in this country. And that's how Afrikaans comes into being. So that's a much more interesting and exciting story. And suddenly I was liberated from the shackles of Afrikaans, because I wouldn't go near it in those years. You know, the idea of singing or speaking Afrikaans was politically anathema. But now I discover that I've been duped and I need to explore. And this is where this whole thing begins and culminates, I suppose, in Guma and also, of course, Karugatar Blues.
When we saw Guma, Of course, we had brought with us years and years of time in Indonesia, and that's an integral part of that universe as well. And as we listened, it brought to mind a circumstance that had hit me back then. A man in Cape Town had written a letter to a news magazine in Indonesia saying he had in his possession a family Quran and a ceremonial sword, which had come through generations from the island of Ternate, which is in the eastern part of Indonesia, which is what was then part of the so-called Spice Islands. And this went back 300-odd years, and he was looking for some way to connect up to conceivable ancestors or common descendants of ancestors to return these items. And the Quran obviously is written in Arabic, but the inscription in the front is Arabic letters. But when he found someone who could read it phonetically, it turned out to be an early version of Proto-Afrikaans.
Now, that's now an established fact that the first Afrikaans that was ever written down was phonetic, and it was written in Arabic. So yes, so there's proof of that. And that's the earliest time that we find Afrikaans being, you know, written down, but in Arabic. You're quite there. Yeah, exactly that.
Take me through from that starting point to your discovery or rediscovery or reimagining of the world of District 6. But we'll get to that in just a minute. First, we're going to take an ad break. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm really pleased to be speaking with David Kremer.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today is the inestimable David Kremer, musician, composer, thinker about the origins of music. And just before the break, we were talking about the transition in his mind, in his work, from this search for origins to how you end up with a show that really touches common humanity, but is deeply embedded in Cape culture, which of course is District 6, which played in this country for months on end in various performances, and I believe around in various parts of the world, as other parts of the world as well. That's a whole universe that you and Tali envisioned and put on stage. And how did that occur?
Yeah, so that definitely is connected to this idea of finding and discovering the true history of Afrikaans. And what happens is I write a few popular songs like Royal Hotel and others, which, you know, makes the hit parade on the radio. And, you know, from that I think you mentioned the Volkswagen bus ads that I did, and I'm on television on my bicycle with my red shoes, and you know, I become a household name and recognized all over the place. But in the meantime, so a few years of that, but then I get to a point where Barney Simon from the Market Theatre, you probably remember Brooks. So he was the artistic director at the Market Theatre in the 1980s, and I was fortunate to work with him for a little while. And he says to me, you know, you are not really a radio artist, and you know, yes, you've had success on the radio, but what you really, you are a storyteller, he says to me. And because you could write songs not only for yourself, but you could write for other people. So we did an experiment where I took some of this. You know, I would always be singing perhaps in the third person about somebody. And then he says, let's give this to another singer and we rewrite the song in the first person and let them sing it as a character, which we did, and it was wonderful. And I was very excited by the results of that. And so I started to, this is about 1985 or 84, I start to think of myself now more as a storyteller, using music and writing for singers and actors. So that, and where does that leads to musical So I think, oh, I must write a musical. That's what I'd like to do. It's something I'd want to explore. And it happened that in 1986, there is a mention in the newspaper that it's been 20 years since the declaration of District 6 as a white group area. So I think, oh, that's interesting. I'd sort of forgotten about District 6. It was already gone. You know, it had been, everyone had been moved and been razed to the ground. And I thought about this and I thought, you know, if District 6 actually probably have all of the things that I'm interested in, the kind of music, the origins of, you know, the Moppies and the Malay Karinkle songs, sentimentals, and then, of course, you know, it has the carnival element, and it has the Malay choir element, and then it also had a sort of pop rock and roll element where people were performing on the stages of the cinemas in those days. And so it struck me that there was a lot of potential for exploring the kind of music that I was interested in and loved. Of course, I wasn't had nothing to do with the theatre other than performing on the stage. And I had no knowledge of musicals. So when I met up with Talib, just by chance, we went to see if we were both at a film about District 6. And he says to me, you know, I want to talk to you about, I want to resurrect my cabaret review about District 6. And I said, I'm writing a musical about District 6. And I realized I need to work with someone who came from District 6. And of course, politically, I understood, you know, I was never going to pull it off as a so-called white person, you know, trying to write about the history of that. I knew that I would be rejected no matter what I did. You know, who am I to tell the story of this community? So having Talib as a partner was great in terms that he was very musically, as a musician, he was very sophisticated, much more advanced than I was. But he also came from District 6. And so the authenticity of his story and the fact that we were working together, you know, we allowed us to dodge the kind of criticism that we would have got at the time.
I had forgotten about Barney Simon's involvement in this process, and it makes me realize that Barney is crucial to what I think of as the two bookends of musical theater for this country, and certainly that period, your show and, of course, the Junction Avenue Theater Company's Sophiatown. And they both emerge at about the same time. They're about different experiences in the same way. And they tell their stories through music.
Correct. Both tell this, you know, the story of the group areas and forced removals. One being in Sophiatown, and the other being down here in District 6. I wasn't aware at the time they were doing that. I'm sure they didn't know we were doing District 6, but they did emerge almost at the same time. Maybe Sophiatown a little earlier. But yes, and again, when I wrote the musical with Talib, we did it on instinct, pure instinct. We didn't have anybody really advising us or guiding us. Unfortunately, you know, Barney was up in the Market Theatre in Johannesburg, so we were working here on our own. I didn't have Barney's guidance, which would have perhaps been useful or perhaps not. I don't know. Barney also had his ideas about the way things should be done. But so we just dived in and wrote this story, these characters. And luckily for us, we wrote some damn good songs about that the people really responded to. I mean, they just loved the songs about District 6 that the Talib and I wrote. And
so that's... As you talk, the parentless child who I can't whistle, I can't hum, I can't sing, but it's playing.
The song, well, one of the main ones was called "My Bruchi, My Bra." He never knew his dada. His mama never kissed him. Nobody loved him. Nobody missed him. My Bruchi, My Bra. only 9 years old, ran away from home, struggles on his own, outside in the cold. That one, that was a big one. Still is today. A classic. It's become a classic.
I hear it right in my head. Today.
Yeah.
I didn't expect we were going to ask you to sing, but I'm glad you did. Now, I want to jump ahead slightly in time, obviously, not historical time, but career time. You went from this reconstruction, revivifying that culture to a wholly different topic, which, of course, is American minstrel traveling troops around the world. In this case, the Virginia Jubilee Singers and Orpheus McAdoo, which is now playing in Cape Town. It's a, I think, a refiguring in some ways of this extraordinary tale. But I'll let you tell it because I think you probably know it better than I do by a long shot.
Yes, well, so I came across the story of Orpheus McAdoo and the Virginia Jubilee Concert Company. I bought a book, and in this book was a photograph of this company, an African-American company who visit Cape Town in 1890. And there they are, dressed in Victorian attire, top hats, tails, looking. And I thought, what is this? What's, you know, I've never heard about these people. Again, so it was hidden history. And I'm particularly interested in stories that have been suppressed because it doesn't fit the establishment's narrative. So I wanted to find out more. This was about 10, 11 years ago, and it was a fascinating story. And let me just say to you, Brooks, he would have been very upset to be described as a minstrel show. Jubilee singers. Yeah.
Right.
And so much of my story is about this conflict between the Jubilee singers and their politics, what the uplift politics that Booker T. Washington, that was one side of the, you know, the freedmen. How do you now that people have been freed from slavery in America and they have access to education, and, you know, that's the one side of it. How do you present yourself as a freed black man in America and to the world? And on the other hand, we've had a lot of blackface minstrelsy stretching much further back, where, of course, you know, it started as with white men in blackface doing these parodies. But by the time we get to the sort of 1870s, 1880s, the freedom allows black entertainers to go down the minstrel route. And they start wearing blackface. And, of course, much to the annoyance of someone like McAdoo. So this is one of the sort of core conflicts of the story I'm telling, how there were two ways that they approached the new freedoms. And McAdoo was very much in opposition to blackface minstrelsy, especially being donned by black people. And it's all based on fact. These things all happened. They, although I can't find much evidence of an African-American minstrel troupe coming to South Africa, but they were all over Australia at the same time. They had enormous success in Australia, as did McAdoo. And, you know, the interesting fact is that there were more African-American performers at that time in Australia working professionally than there were in America. They found that Australia was a good place for them, and they all headed there as soon as they could, because the opportunities within America at that time, of course, were hardly satisfactory.
David, we're going to take another ad break. If we don't do it, then, as I say, we get into trouble. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, my privilege, David Kramer, musician, composer, chronicler of a distant age that deserves much more attention, and now with a new or a reconfigured show, The Life of Orpheus McAdoo, American Virginia Jubilee Singers leader and performer in South Africa. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, David Kremer. We were talking just before the ad break about the origins of Orpheus McAdoo. What I wanted to ask is, how did you research the music? Did you know his playlist, for example, or did you have to reconceive what he would have and his group would have performed, or did you just guess? How did you come up with the songs?
So that intrigued me. I mean, the first thing was, what would they have sung? And I was able to find some academic work that had been done on his travels in South Africa, also a very good academic paper that had been done in America. And those two gave me a lot of insight. In the one paper by Veit Uhlmann, he says that, you know, they were invited to come to the Transvaal and perform to President Kruger. So that was intriguing, the idea. And Kruger had never even put his foot in a theater before. But they accepted the invitation and went up and performed a concert for Kruger and his staff. And there is a record of the songs they sang. So I was able to see the kind of jubilees that they sang, as well as what the Scottish airs and glees and little extracts from here and there. But mostly people will recognize what we think of as spirituals today. They sang sang songs like "Didn't My Lord Deliver Daniel, Deliver Daniel," you know, "I'm Rolling Through an Unfriendly World," "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot," of course, big one, and amazing, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, those kind of songs. So now I knew where I was. And of course, one can find recordings made a few decades later of Jubilee singing. The recordings at around about 1910 of the Fisk Jubilee Singers from Nashville. So I had a very good idea of what they would have sounded like. And this is the thing with this production with Cape Town Opera Company, is that having these wonderful operatic voices has allowed me to reproduce the choir as it would have been 120 years ago. The sound of those voices, because they were incredibly powerful singers. I mean, there's an account in Scotland, they sang to an audience of over 4,000 people. This is with no microphones. 4,000 people. I mean, it's hard enough singing to 40 people, 400 people. So it was a different way of performing and listening in those years. And I thought it would really be wonderful to sort of create a time capsule where today's audience can go back to 1890 and hear them singing, which is exactly what you will find if you come to Orpheus McAdoo, the musical, on at Artscape at the moment.
And it just opened.
Yes, it's just opened. I mean, it was lovely to be in the opening night audience and to just see people almost leaning forward in their seats, absorbing the story, which of course fascinated them. No one knows about this story in South Africa. And in fact, Orpheus McAdoo is a completely forgotten figure because he died at the age of 42. He arrived here, he was 32 years old, he was an impresario. I mean, an amazing man. And he took on an international tour at the age of 32 with a company of 10 or 12 and had huge success here in Australia. But he dies at 42 years old in Sydney and sort of never to be heard of again. Had he gone back to America, I think he would have made a name for himself there. In a similar way that we know the Fisk Jubilee Singers, and but then, of course, and the ragtime artists who followed later. I mean, we know quite a few ragtime. But ragtime, you know, starts in Chicago, but also gets developed in Australia. And Orpheus was partly responsible for that.
One question, one hope, one plea with you is that, yes, I know you're doing this in Cape Town, and it's on, and I'm sure the crowds are delighted to see it. But we live in Johannesburg. You know what I'm going to ask. When is it coming this way?
Of course. So this is a Cape Town Opera production. Hopefully they will want to tour the show, I think, more internationally than locally. There's potential in Europe, and I wouldn't suggest we go to America. You know, the Coles to Newcastle kind of thing. But Europe would be very interested in this. And I know that Cape Town Opera are very excited with this production that we have now achieved. It's a Broadway. It's a Broadway production. It's a huge musical. And to move it around, of course, it costs way too much money. And there's no support. You know, Mr. McKenzie is not going to dive in and help us out here. So, unfortunately, you have to come to Cape Town. And if, like, you have to go to Broadway if you want to see a show like this, is a Broadway production in Cape Town, in the heart of Cape Town. And that's exactly what it is. It doesn't travel easily. It's not a touring show.
The publicist asked if we were coming, and I had to say, unfortunately, we just came back. So we're not coming to Cape Town just yet. This show runs until early November.
Second of November. Again, we just have this rather tight, it's a time slot that's allocated to the opera company. And so we're using that time slot. But I was feeling very, very encouraged by the opening night and the response from the audience, and the feeling that, you know, having worked on the show for 10 years, it first started at the Fugard Theatre, I think 2015 or 14. And every time, and then, that closes down and you think, oh, I would have liked to have done it a little differently and I could have fixed this and fixed that. And, you know, then I got another opportunity with them to do it again and I made changes. And then last year with Cape Town Opera, we did a new version, a revival, and that went well. But once again, me being who I am, I'm never satisfied and I want to change. And so they were very, very generous in giving me an opportunity to do this new revival production. And I think, this is my last shot at it, and I'm feeling good. I think we have arrived with the sort of product that I had always hoped we would achieve.
Well, I'm going to let me go in a slightly different direction. Cape Town Opera just did a production of the Verdi opera Aida, and
yes, it was wonderful.
Beautifully done, well received, imaginatively staged and conceived, and they did a video, a film of it, which
yes,
in many ways
on the circuit, it was Jack Innick or something. Yeah, great.
Yeah, I mean it's still the same opera, but the medium is actually different than seeing it live on stage. And so my suggestion, my thought is, of course, when do the cameras come in to do capture of Orpheus Maka?
They are videoing. I know we've already videoed and one performance, and they probably will video another one. So yes, Cape Town Opera wants to put together a really good film or video version of this show, which they will use as a marketing tool. And who knows, maybe even send it out there with their new relationship with Steakinic, which would be interesting. So no work is being done in that area. And, you know, I think what Johannesburg needs to do is keep asking Cape Town Opera, when are you bringing Orpheus to Johannesburg like you brought Aida? And we'll see what happens there.
I'm going to send Magdalena a note. It's time. You got to bring it up this way. You have to do it. I'm going to plant another idea with you, because you've gotten onto this track of forgotten individuals who are transnational in their way, had huge popularity in their time, but have gradually been lost to history. Ira Aldridge, Black American Shakespearean actor, early 19th century.
Okay. Early 19th century. Yes.
Even earlier than Orpheus Makadu, and he made a name for himself in Britain and Europe. Didn't do so much in the U.S., but he performed not just Othello, but other roles in the Shakespearean canon. There is definitely, in my mind at least, a show there as well, a story about a man who has transcended.
There are a number. I mean, there are quite a few of these stories, and usually their success is in the United Kingdom, outside of America, because they're just, you know, the door was shut in America, but more possibilities in the colonies and in the UK.
David, we're going to take another quick ad break. We're speaking with David Kremer. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back for a closing and a wrap-up. And just maybe we'll let David tell us what he's working on next, what he's thinking about. We'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. My guest today, David Kremer, the man with the sort of semi-pork pie hat and the red felt spoon and the guitar on his back and the bicycle and the VW bus. And
a long time ago.
Yeah, and a list of successful productions as long as your arm. And now with the new and reconceived, reformat, redone Orpheus Makadu. But you're a creative guy, and there's always something else churning inside you after the thing that you have done. In the last couple of minutes, maybe take us through what you're beginning to think about.
Yes, well, you know, my philosophy is try and live a creative life, especially when you get to, you know, sort of this age. A lot of people retire from corporate jobs and they don't know what to do with themselves and end up being depressed. And my advice is always just get involved with something creative, even if it means, you know, making bread, whatever. So I can't do anything but think about shows and new songs. And, you know, that's my daily. I get up and I want to do something creative. So while I'm still capable, I will probably continue. But what's on the horizon now is February next year in 2026 is the 60th anniversary of the declaration of District 6 as a white group area. Mm-hmm. And so we are going to present a commemorative concert at the Opera House in Cape Town for a week of concerts, to introduce to younger generations the energy and the wonderful cultural melting pot that District 6 was, and that's not there today, and so that younger people understand what has been lost and that we don't forget these things. So that's a big show that we are going to do next year. And what is lovely about it is that the four youngsters that were first cast in District 6, the musical, when they were 11 or 12 years old to sing that song, Me Bruchi Me Bra, they are now 50 years old. And the four of them, being Emo Adams and Lukman Adams, his brother, Alistair Isabel and Jody Abrams, have all established themselves as you know, leaders in the entertainment industry. And I have, with my wife Renee, we formed a new company in which they are now the co-producers, and the four of them are going to produce this concert next year. So it's quite a sort of full circle and a really proud moment for me to see these little boys now becoming, you know, big time producers in the Opera House. Very nice.
That's something. I guess if I can't make it down for Orpheus Makadu, we'll have to manage to be in Cape Town for February.
Yes, have a look. Have a look. It's on. If you can book already. And yeah, that would be one. You've got time, but that's it's going to be called From Hanover Street, and it's on web tickets, and it's actually selling quite well right now.
Well, you're something of a household name, so I guess, you know, anything that you're associated with will have an audience, and people will say, "Hey, we got to be there for that."
Good, good. Please come. Please come. Orpheus is a wonderful. I'm really thrilled with Orpheus because it's, for me, it's about how do you tell a good story and integrate great songs. I mean, I'm working with some of these wonderful spirituals and jubilees, but also I've written a lot of songs for the musical, which I'm very proud and happy with. And when you hear these people like Brittany Smith and Conroy Scott singing them, I mean, I just burst into tears. It's just so beautiful to hear people like that sing something I wrote, you know, sitting here with my guitar. So anyway, yes, please come to the theatre, support the theatre, and look out for February next year from Hanover Street.
Well, we just saw Conroy. We just heard Conroy sing the prophet Elijah in the oratorio up here, with a couple thousand people on stage. But he's got a truly versatile voice, and Brittany, of course, sings beautifully.
They're versatile. They can sing opera and they can sing musical. And I mean, to listen to them both in this musical, I think it's, you know, they have a better opportunity of conveying those wonderful talents they have. Orpheus played by Conroy, gives him opportunity to act, and you see him as you've never seen him before. And of course, Brittany is a well-known musical performer as well. And the two of them are just magic. It's magic.
David, it's been a pleasure and a delight and an honor to speak with you. We've been talking with David Kremer, who really needs no introduction. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be back again next week. David, thank you very much.